A spiritual path, as you know, is a way of life that engages us completely. No, it's a full-time commitment, a full-time commitment that becomes the foundation for everything we do and everything we become. It, no matter what our beliefs are about God, whether we are in a traditional faith tradition or not, this path shapes our life, and it determines what we value most, and also, of course, how we relate to others. Religions, we know, differ on matters of doctrine. Ideas about God and religious practices vary widely. But without exception, all authentic spiritual traditions are grounded in love. Within every faith tradition, and it seems like none is immune, we find groups and individuals who are intent on division, sometimes on domination. But across faiths, we find seekers who are lovers of truth and goodness and peace and justice making, and these are the ones we look to. Somehow, loving in action is, for us, the mark of the spiritual individual. How love informs a life, and we are drawn to that loving. Within its influence, we feel whole, somehow healed from the inside out. A theosophical classic which many of you will be familiar with is the slender little journal, actually, at the feet of the master that was shared by the young Jiddu Krishnamurti with a friend. Krishnamurti, as a boy, was taught by an adept teacher, his guru, and he shared what the teacher told him. It was an oral transmission with a friend who wrote it down. So this is at the feet of the master. And this is what the teacher said about love. Of all the qualifications, love is the most important. It is not so much desire as will, resolve, determination. To produce its result, this resolve must fill your whole nature, so as to leave no room for any other feeling. It is indeed the will to be one with God, not in order that you may escape from weariness or suffering, but in order that because of your deep love for Him, you may act with God and as He does. Because God is love, if you would be one with that, you must be filled with perfect unselfishness and love also. Now, let us reflect for a moment on the master's intention. The adept teacher in this case follows a Buddhist path, a Tibetan Buddhist path, and he does not hold to conventional Western notions about God. He certainly does not hold to the idea that the infinite can be conceived of as a male, personal individual. However, he is speaking to the young Krishnamurti, his young disciple, in words that the child will understand. What or who then is this God of which we are more or less aware? Each of us here knows that there is a life, perhaps a force, within ourselves and all things. This is a universal human experience. For some, ultimate reality is a transcendent, impersonal principle, perhaps an undivided unity or oneness. And for others, this infinite life is wisdom and love and truth incarnate in a personal form. The master says simply that God is love. He expects the young disciple to feel into what he means and to sense into the experience and ways of love, both human and transcendent. Again, the Master speaks of love as determination, will force, resolve. Love is then, according to this teacher, beyond desire, with its craving and grasping. As a spiritual reality, love is unconditional. It's not dependent on particular circumstances or forms. It simply is, whether we know it or not. It is always wholehearted, just like the sun, which is its symbol across all faiths. This love shines for all. In the wisdom tradition, the theosophical tradition, love is a supreme force that links all beings in what we call an unbroken wholeness. It mandates unity for us. It not only makes our individualities possible, bringing out the best in us, but it also mandates that we connect in an interior way with each other, that we realize the connections that are eternal, that are already there, that are making our own life possible. The only way one can know God then is through intending goodwill. The golden rule, which is found in every faith in similar forms, is simply this. It is a resolve to live in love. We're used to knowing things from the outside, looking at their shapes, taking them apart, reassembling them. Even research today in medicine is a lot about dissection, about the destruction of living forms in order that we may have or perhaps enjoy the luxury of a longer physical life. If we relate to living things this way, relationships become a cold and sterile affair. In order really to know something and to ensure our longevity, our immortality, we have to know things from the inside out to become as they are. This is knowing by identification, by becoming at one with that which we seek to understand. We extend a hand then in friendship, and in time, friendship develops into caring, and it's the same with God. To know that immortal and infinite life, one begins with caring, caring for everything, as God does. We're childlike about this at first. We'd like friendship on our own terms. But the Master says that perfect unselfishness is the key, and there is no mystery in this, because the message is the same in every faith tradition. The false self must disappear. There is another self within us that is waiting to emerge. The false self is fearful, insecure, needy, clingy, grasping. It can be safely surrendered, and nothing worthwhile is lost. What happens is that a spaciousness occurs, an emptiness which is waiting to be filled. And it's said that God fills in all the empty spaces with itself, its own life. Loving then brings out the best in ourselves and others, that which is just under the surface, waiting to emerge. And whether in ourselves or others, this wisdom and strength and peace emerges, matters not at all. It is all the same life. Loving begins with the power of sympathy, sensing into one's own or another's body, emotions, and mind. Nature is a network of sympathetic energies. All beings sense into one another. Mystics and intuitives converse with mountain spirits, and they say that certain rocks and crystals develop an affinity for humans. Even when their caregivers are far from home, plants can sense into their changing behaviors. Sympathy is a resonance that connects us to everything within and around us. And sympathetic and also then telepathic events or phenomena happen outside our usual notions of space and time. Sympathy is needed not only for survival, but for evolution. All beings, visible and invisible, growing together. Sympathy may show itself in animals as an intense desire and power to return home. Some recorded cases are remarkable because there's no obvious way the animal could have known the way home. Bobby was a young female collie who was traveling from the family's home in Ohio to a new home in Oregon. The family had made this trip before, but not Bobby. This was her first time. And the family stopped in Indiana. Bobby wandered away, became lost, and could not be found. The family lingered and searched, but finally, not able to locate Bobby, they proceeded. 3 months later, Bobby appeared on the doorstep of the new home in Oregon. Another story is told of a young boy, Hugh Brady, who raised homing pigeons, kept homing pigeons as pets. And one day, he found a pigeon in his garden whom he befriended and nursed back to health. It was an injured bird. The next winter, Hugh was taken ill and sent to a hospital 200 miles away for surgery. While he was still recovering in the hospital, on a bitterly cold and snowy night, he heard a tapping at the window of his hospital room. He asked a nurse to open the window, and in fluttered his befriended bird, who landed right on his chest. Now, this bird, the befriended pigeon, was not homing. He was coming to a place that he had never been. So within us and all things, we have an instinct for where we need to be, a kind of sympathy with hidden forces, hidden lives with which we need to connect. When we are still and long for these connections, they happen quite naturally. And we find our wings, or we find our paws, or we follow our nose. It's all the same. And we can see it everywhere in nature around us. A related and deeper form of caring is empathy, the power to put oneself in another's place. Caring actions arising from empathy may happen despite danger to the giver. Empathy may be the first arising of an unselfish love. Recently in the paper, our newspaper, there was a little account of a family of elephants, one of whom, a female, was carrying with her dead newborn calf. The whole family of elephants, which normally was very vigilant and moving in order for survival, the whole family paced itself to this mother carrying her dead baby for several days until she was able to release this infant. At that time, the family moved on together. This is more than just survival behavior. It implies, and we know this is true of elephant communities, a deep affinity, a kind of heart affinity between these creatures. One that involves intelligence and caring. There's also a quite remarkable story of a man by the name of Jim Gilchrist, who's from Ontario. He is a dog trainer and was out walking with his dogs. He has two dogs, a three-year-old Rottweiler named Tara, female, and a year-old golden retriever named Tyree. The three of them were out walking and wandered out onto a frozen lake, and he was not watchful and fell through the ice. He was, of course, dressed in heavy clothing and sank and kept bobbing to the surface. But the ice, when he tried to haul himself back up on the ice, it was too thin. He said, I could barely move with all my heavy clothing on, and my head sank below the surface again and again. He figured that the dogs would take off and go for help. They were well trained, but they stayed. And in fact, the Rottweiler jumped into the water with him, Tara. However, she had as difficult a time as he. She tried to nudge him upward with her nose, but was unable to, and in fact was floundering. And he remembered thinking that his heart was broken, that she might drown with him. He tried to shove her out of the water, but she was too heavy, the ice was too thin, and it kept breaking. He said, what happened next was astonishing. And I'll give you his words. With no help anywhere in sight, my one-year-old retriever, Tyree, did just what anyone trying a treacherous ice rescue would do. I saw Tyree lie down on her belly and begin inching her way toward me. I'll never know how she got the idea to spread herself out to prevent the ice from cracking under her feet, but that's what she did. Finally, she got close enough for me to grab her collar. I used her as an anchor with one hand and shoved Tara out of the water with my other arm. Suddenly, Tara, who was now up on the ice, he said, this is a heavy Rottweiler, she's a big dog, began copying Tyree. She lay down and spread-eagled out her paws. Both of them extended their collars to me, and I hung on to each with one hand. Then came the most beautiful moment I have ever experienced. The dogs began inching backward, pulling me out of my watery grave bit by bit. Minutes later, they had pulled me off the thin ice, and I could stand. They had saved my life. Now, when we hear of such caring between animals or between animals and ourselves, it seems natural and right. But empathy among people can go awry. When the power of empathy is used to humiliate and to control others, it becomes a dark energy that is bereft of soul. Mitch Albom, who wrote, are you familiar with Tuesdays with Maury? We're fortunate to have Mitch living in Detroit. He's a sports writer. He was trying to get back to Detroit, and he was coming in from Ohio, so I expect he was coming in from the Cleveland area. His flight was canceled, and so he hailed a cab. And the cab driver was a very thin black fellow, and the first part of the trip was uneventful. It was a hot summer night. But before long, he saw the young driver glance in the rearview mirror and say, oh no, and they were stopped by a patrolman, a state policeman. They rolled the windows down. It was a hot summer night. And he said that the trooper looked like someone who had seen too many cop movies. He had on dark glasses, and he was, you know, he sauntered over, and he was arrogant and so forth, and ordered the young cab driver, whose name was Mersal Doody, out of the car. And he kept him for 20 minutes in the squad car. And Mitch Albom could see through the rearview mirror, and he saw the boy waving his hands sort of helplessly and frustrated. And finally, the young man came back. He had a speeding ticket, and they continued. And then he told Mitch Albom that the trooper had insisted that he was running drugs, that the only reason that he was going to Detroit was drugs, and that he needed to admit that the car was stolen. For 20 minutes, he badgered the young man with this intimidation. The young man was frustrated and angry, but over the rest of the trip, told his story. It turned out that he had come over not too long ago from Somalia. When he was 15 years old, he arrived home one day. There was a lot of warfare at that time in Somalia. And he had arrived home, and a rival gang had entered his home. The home was filled with blood. His two brothers had been killed. Mother and sister had been raped. Several other brothers, mother and father, father was a professor were carried away. There was no one there, and he was left to him his own wits. He said he didn't eat for 7 days a week. Gradually, he made his way into Nigeria, into Kenya, back to Somalia, living with other refugees, making a living washing dishes and so forth. And finally, by a stroke of luck, the refugees in one camp had a kind of lottery, and they gathered enough money so that one person could travel out, and he won, and he came to the States. And at that time, when he was driving a cab, he was in college, and he was trying to get enough money to get his parents out. He finally heard from his mom, who contacted him through the Red Cross, and she and his father, several brothers and sisters, were in refugee camps somewhere near between Kenya and Somalia. He was trying to gather enough to bring them out. So here we have a situation of intimidation and ugliness, no attempt to get to know someone at all. But on the part of the trooper, knowing very well how to humiliate and deride. We also have here a wonderful example of how love exists or coexists with all of this ugliness and treachery. We have Mitch Albom, who listens, who is available to help. We have all of this network of friends and casual acquaintances in the refugees that helped this young man get over here. So we have all kinds of energy moving in this situation. It's complex and it's beautiful, and it is the way of love. Love doesn't avoid darkness. It doesn't avoid shadow. It's the ability, as St. Francis knew in his beautiful prayer, it's the ability to move fully into the darkness when it faces us, and there to be simply ourselves and to bring whatever light we can. Bringing that light is what compassion is all about. Compassion is the deepening of empathy and sympathy. Whereas in sympathy and empathy, the self, there can still be self-interest, self-serving. In compassion, there cannot be. Here there is a strong, self-conscious individual. And yet that individual is able to act in a situation without thought of consequences to self or without regard to reward. Dora Kunz, who was a great healer, a medical intuitive, president of the Theosophical Society for quite a while, used to say that the key to healing was being able to work without thought of results, to simply work, to simply be there, to do what one could, to be fully present. And you could feel that in the work that she did. When she was with a patient, she was fully engaged. And the minute the individual went out the door, it was as though he had never been there. She was into the next moment. Rachel Naomi Remen, I'm sure some of you have heard of her. She's very well known. She is a psychotherapist, oncologist who works on the West Coast, has written some beautiful books, including Kitchen Table Wisdom, a wonderful collection of essays. She has experienced a life-threatening illness for most of her life, chronic illness. And she makes a sharp distinction between fixing, helping, and serving. Fixing and helping, like sympathy and empathy, can, as we have said, be self-serving. We can fix most anything without being involved. Fixing is a matter of knowing how things fit together. A surgeon can replace your damaged knee without ever getting to know you. The procedure can be quite routine. Helping requires some engagement. You'll need to walk again. Learn to walk again with that new knee. Support staff will know your movement patterns, your pain tolerance, how motivated you are to heal. They'll get to know your family. Professional help can be outwardly useful and still leave you feeling alone. Anyone who has been hospitalized knows this experience. Helping is often tinged with feelings of superiority. The sense of separateness is there. And in much of healthcare worldwide, clients are objects to be helped through the system as efficiently as possible. There's often frustration and isolation, not only among patients, but among staff who find themselves putting efficiency before caring. This is one of the reasons burnout is so high, especially in critical care areas in our hospitals. Service is the natural outflowing of compassion or altruism, where there is no sense of separation, and holistic health care actually is intended to serve the wholeness of the client, the caregivers, the family, and the community. There is mutual support, mutual benefit, mutual appreciation. Holistic care can only take place when all the participants take responsibility for each other. Illness is never a singular or an isolated event. Everywhere in nature and society, healing is going on moment by moment for all of us. We are all suffering, we are all in pain at some level, and we are all healing in our own way and time. The spirit of love, which is moving within all of us, is this supreme healer, but it needs compassionate servants. I want to share with you another story written by Terry Dobson, was a young man at the time, and it's a story that's shared in a paperback book called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart. These are his words. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty. A few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and the dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore laborer's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple, and it was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled toward the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed the metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I'd been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. Trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you are already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even went so far as to cross the streets to avoid the chimpira, the pinball punks who lounged around the train station. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself, getting to my feet. People are in danger, and if I don't do something, they will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized a chance to focus his rage. "Aha," he roared, "a foreigner. You need a lesson in Japanese manners." I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. "All right," he hollered. "You're going to get a lesson." He gathered himself for a rush at me. A split second before he could move, someone shouted, "Hey!" It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he suddenly stumbled upon it. "Hey!" I wheeled to my left. The drunk spun to his right. We both stared down at a little old Japanese. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but he beamed delightedly at the laborer as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. "Come here," the old man said in an easy vernacular, beckoning to the drunk. "Come here and talk with me." He waved his hand lightly. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, "Why the hell should I talk to you?" The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. "What you been drinking?" he asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. "I've been drinking sake," the laborer bellowed back, "and it's none of your business." Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. "Oh, that's wonderful," the old man said. "Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every night, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we warm up a little bottle of sake and take it out into the garden, and we sit on an old wooden bench. We watch the sun go down, and we look to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My great-grandfather planted that tree, and we worry about whether it will recover from these ice storms. Our tree has done better than I expected, though, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. It's gratifying to watch when we take our sake and go out to enjoy the evening, even when it rains." He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fists slowly unclenched. "Yeah," he said. "I love persimmons, too." His voice trailed off. "Yes," said the old man, smiling, "and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife." "No," replied the laborer. "My wife died." Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. "I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself." Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the doors opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said, "that is a difficult predicament. Sit down here. Tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on his seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with kind words. I had just seen Aikido tried in combat, and the essence of it was love. I would have to practice the art with an entirely different spirit. It would be a long time before I could speak about the resolution of conflict. One African tribe has a beautiful way of greeting each other. I say to you, I am here. And you reply, I see you. How often do we see each other? How often do we hear the still small voice within the heart, the voice of conscience, the voice of love, and say, I see you? The foundation for the spiritual life takes many forms. In every religion, there are commandments, rules, a foundation for ethical living. And they are all similar. The foundation is about, first of all, doing away with all of those physical and emotional and mental restless energies. Energies of attachment, energies of repelling, energies of inertia that keep us from connecting with each other, with our own innermost life, with all other forms of life, animate and inanimate, visible and invisible. Somehow things need to be settled down. I have a handout which I would like us to work with. This is the ethical foundations of yoga. And it's the foundations as they're found in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Patanjali attempted to compile the essence of yoga. And it is amazingly applicable to the science of spiritual unfoldment. Whether it's found in Eastern or Western faiths. The interesting thing about this is, though, that it gives us a sense of what happens when we begin to practice a certain way of life. There is an effect, an inevitable effect, if our practice is wholehearted. The word yoga is derived from the Sanskrit root yuj, which means to join. It suggests that in Hindu philosophy, the human soul is an aspect or reflects perfectly the spiritual reality, which is the substratum of our universe. Although in essence the two are indivisible, still in our growth we need to reunite ourselves consciously with this source. It says a little bit about the Yoga Sutras, and then morality of a higher order is not always necessary for yoga. Lower yoga has for its object the development of certain psychic faculties and supernormal powers called siddhis. For this, the morality implied in this practice, yama niyama, is not necessary. These actually act as a hindrance, causing inner conflict and preventing the yogi from seeking personal power and influence. But the higher yoga of the Yoga Sutras requires a transcendent morality based on the higher laws of nature. Its goal is enlightenment and liberation from the bonds of illusion. The main object of this code is to eliminate completely all mental and emotional disturbances which block insight, compassion, and unselfish action. It's been loosely translated as restraint or abstention or letting go. In other words, we let go of certain things to make a space for something else to happen. And the next part is niyama, which are translated observances. And these are the things that we practice: purity, simplicity, self-training, self-study, and so forth, resignation to God, devotion. Let us work with the first portions, the releasings, releasing violence, falsehood, stealing, pleasure-seeking, acquisitiveness. And what I'd like you to do is to form little groups of perhaps three or four people, and each one of you take a different one and see how, if you can get a sense of how releasing violence, for example, can result in all enmity ceasing in the presence of one who is totally nonviolent. Okay? Or taking releasing falsehood, The effect is becoming true. One's actions become creative and full of power. See if you can get a sense of how these are connected, how one leads inevitably to the other. For example, in looking at violence, we're looking at violence at a number of different levels, some of them very, very subtle. Okay? Okay, everybody. The group on violence, abstention from violence.
We began, one of the members in our group remembered the story of Peace Pilgrim, the woman who walked for miles and miles and devoted quite a few years of her life, I don't know how many, does anyone know? Quote, devoted quite a few years of her life spreading the word of peace. And how sort of energetically, like a ripple in the pond, she brought peace wherever she went. So there was a releasing and a calming effect. And then each of us shared some story about people we knew, your name came up, who had that kind of influence over us when we're in their presence. So we could each feel that almost in our bodies as we were talking about it. We even became a little calmer, I think. And then Ruth Ann brought up, I thought, a point that we all tried to help articulate, which was about we come into the world under duress. And it's kind of a startling event. And we hold, over a period of time, a lot of tension or anxiety as things happen to us in life. And we, you were sort of using as a metaphor the clenched fist and the open hand. I don't know if you could help me speak to that.
Well, I meant that when we come into birth, we're first in this fluid and we're peacefully, you know, just sort of rocking there, and then we're thrust out through the birth canal, which is a jarring experience, or a violent experience in that way. And as we grow up, we begin to hold tension in our body that doesn't dissipate, you know, through just the experiences of life. Sometimes it's really negative things, like being, you know, physically or emotionally abused or something, and sometimes it's just stuff that happens over life. And we begin to hold more and more tension in our body that we are not even aware of. And then you hear about the person, you know, the quiet man who all of a sudden goes and does something horrible. And you say, my gosh, he was such a quiet soul. But all it takes is this small little thing to set one off. And I was saying that different of the things I've done, body kinds of things, Tai Chi, yoga, meditation, massage, and so on, have like taken this body that's stressed like this, that people are not even aware of, and slowly made it less and less tense. So bringing that calm. And it can be violence in potentiality if you don't release some of that tense.
Thank you. Thank you.
And from that, we went on to talk a little bit about institutionalized violence, which sometimes in our culture we become so used to. Even in our school systems, we have sort of negatively competitive behavior that carries a negative energy, and it kind of seeps into the environment and affects the way people behave. Or acts of violence we commit against ourselves. I said that I realized at one point in my life that I needed to quit smoking if I was going to be a peace advocate, because how could I possibly talk about bringing peace in the world when I was committing acts of violence against my own body?
Thank you. Yes.
I'm not sure we can speak to any one thing as a group. Glenda was talking a little bit about the pleasure-seeking area. You want to share that with
us? Frank had brought it up that in order to, and so did Maria, previously, that in order to be filled with the positive energy or the love or compassion, oftentimes we had to be emptied. And one of the things that came up for me personally, being a mother, was that I didn't realize until I was emptied how many times I fixed. No matter what the problem was with my family, I fixed it, and it got to be a habit. I expected to fix it, and they expected me to fix it, and it made me feel good. It became, and even though I wasn't aware of it at the time, it was a mark of pride for me, of pleasure, and even though periodically I'd say, I don't like this, I don't want to do this anymore, I didn't know what to do about it. But I did pray about it a lot and meditated on it. And when I really internally became convinced that that's what I wanted to do, the same as you have to do if you want to quit smoking or anything else, God, the love of the universe, started putting choices in front of me. And it just kind of unfolded. And surprisingly enough, both me and my family have grown a whole lot. And they can fix things too. And also, we have developed a renewed respect for each other. We've developed the ability to be friends and to share without that demeaning side that can happen when you think you're loving someone and you're doing it in a negative way or an unhelpful way or really an unloving way. Because from my experience and from what we shared in our group, it's really easy in today's world to have a concept of love that can be very destructive and demeaning and harmful to the other person and not be aware. I mean, we really think we're loving them because we think we're doing what we think is best.
Thanks, Glenda. Next, group. I was working with abstention from stealing.
Falsehood?
Okay.
As we were discussing falsehood, one thing that came to our mind was that we all know when we are starting to engage in a life of falsehood in any respect, and when we are living a falsehood, we tend to erect an edifice around it. We are defensive. We have to justify our falsehood, and this is a self-centered kind of existence when you are living a life of falsehoods. You can't think about the other people because you are living a life that's false, and you have to make sure that you try to present it as being true when you know it isn't true. And you're just, it's all self. And if you can learn to not be false with yourself, you don't have to worry about erecting an edifice for yourself. You can focus on interacting with others and helping others more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next group.
Well, we had a lot of different input. Ours was abstention from stealing. I think my take from all the input, but I'll kind of paraphrase, is that when we look at life and identify all of the things that we want to possess, we enter into this kind of struggle, this flow. And struggling to get these things, that's, I think, when we're stealing. And if we don't allow that to go within, that these things will come to us. This is not only material things, it can be good health, love, but if we make these things a struggle, then it's more or less the essence of stealing. And also, without the struggle, we take the self out of the self. We're selfless, and then things will come to us. But I think there's also an aspect of desiring for the purpose of being able to share, to give. And that's, I think, also would fit in here as non-stealing. So that was paraphrased.
Thank you. There's so many ways we diminish the life of others. Stealing energy, reputation, becomes a very easy thing to do. Subtle ways we prop ourselves up by taking away from the goodness of others. Okay.
Abstinence of pleasure seeking, which is a huge draw for a lot of people, to be going after what feels good for me right now. And we all talked about that, and there's tons of things that would cause me to not be able to give that feeling of 100% effort towards my wife or my children or anything like that. We all kind of agreed that there's variables every day that are just bombarding you, society, and enabling you to pleasure seek.
It's interesting, the seeking of pleasure, because partly the idea here and is that there is a joy in life, a joy in being who we are, in finding and discovering our own true nature and living it out, our purpose. And there are many options for that. And that's where the joy is. We don't have to seek it. We don't have to grasp and hold onto temporary pleasures. But that everything as the senses begin to open and one begins to relate to all forms of life in love, joy is released. And one doesn't need to seek it. It finds us because the very nature of life is happiness. Did you want to say something?
The best thing I could think of in this whole deal is that pleasure seeking for me could be more like a distractions that I get into to take myself away from myself. If I wasn't putting that energy into the distractions, I'd have the energy to be here now. If I didn't have the desire for a certain pleasure, then I'd have more strength because I couldn't be manipulated because someone couldn't maybe take that away from me. That's the best I can come up with. Right?
That's great. That's great. We're all in the same boat.
It's the truth.
Yes?
As we're talking about, well, we're so busy asking why that we lose sight of one another, and also talking about attachments to temporary things, big salaries, families, forgetting what is really important. It's not how much we have, this attachment. But also I was thinking, without this attachment, then what? Then we got into that. Without asking, well, we would then sort of integrate one another's talents and come together rather than...
Think more of what brings us... What our commonalities are, not what makes us different. Not that I have this or I have that. It's like, oh, you know, we have this.
Especially important in community or in family, as Glenda was suggesting, you know. I mean, we meet each other's needs quite naturally. We don't have to. But sometimes the expectations we have of each other get in the way. Well, I thank you all very much.